Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. Glad to be back with you again for our second week on the air. Here is what we're up to. You know, each week there are certain stories that catch our attention, make us want to go deeper, find a personal angle, maybe play around a little bit. This is our chance to grab a few of those flashing headlines and leave you with a little more to think about as we head into next week. If you want to catch up, hear last week's show, find out how you can get involved, we're at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. One of the big stories we want to get into this week actually stems from an event earlier this month. The biggest U.S. immigration raid ever at a single site in Postville, Iowa. 300 workers, most from Mexico and Guatemala, are beginning their jail sentences this week. 5 months and then deportation, most likely. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement went into the plant looking for 800 workers. The company is Agriprocessors, Inc., and it's the world's largest kosher slaughterhouse. This plant in the middle of the Midwest is owned and run by a family from the Lubavitch sect of Hasidic Judaism. The story has so many fascinating and uncomfortable details. This huge raid was so traumatic for the town and for everybody involved, but the significance of it has gotten a little bit lost outside of Iowa, and so here we are. We asked Agriprocessors for an interview, but they say they can't comment on a pending legal matter other than to say they're cooperating with the government, improving their hiring practices, and doing an internal investigation. Stephen Bloom is a professor of journalism at the University of Iowa, and more than anybody, I would guess he has sort of been waiting for all this to go down. In 2000, he wrote the book Postville, A Clash of Cultures in Heartland America. Glad to have you with us, Professor Bloom from Iowa City.
Great to be here, Jeff. Thank you.
So that was 8 years ago that the book came out. What did you learn even then that might have suggested to you that something like this was coming?
Let me set the scene for writing this book. Initially, in Postville, the locals were delighted that the Hasidim had picked their community to launch the slaughterhouse. But gradually, things began to fall apart. In fact, the Lubavitchers really did not want to mix with the locals. They came to Postville for one very American reason, and that was to make money. Something that's very important, Jeff, to mention is it was no secret that undocumented workers were being hired to man the kill floor. Politicians knew about it. Local people in Postville knew it. Workers in the plant knew it. So it wasn't really a question of whether the government was going to crack down and raid agriprocessors. It really was a question of when.
If everybody in this area of Iowa knew exactly what was going on, why did it take years and years and years for ICE, for the government, to take action in this situation?
That's the $64,000 question. Management, I am convinced, absolutely, without a doubt, knew it was hiring undocumented workers with forged Social Security cards. I think it was the cost of doing business. It's a little bit like driving 90 miles an hour on the highway. You need to get your destination, and you'd like to get there a half hour early. And so you break the law and you drive 90 miles an hour. You get stopped by a trooper. You pay the fine, and you'll continue driving 90 miles an hour. These are acceptable expenses, I believe. Nothing has happened yet to the owners of the slaughterhouse. They've been driving 90 miles an hour for years and years and years, and now the trooper stops them, and the trooper says, you can't be doing this. Why did it take so long? You got to direct that question to someone in the government.
And as they've said, it's a very complicated investigation. I guess they had sources inside the plant and needed to build the case. Presuming perhaps there is a bigger case to come beyond simply just charging the illegal workers who were there.
The affidavit supporting the raid alleged that there was a methamphetamine lab actively operating on the kill floor of the slaughterhouse. The affidavit also alleged guns were being trafficked on the kill floor. What happens to the managers who, it's been shown, helped arrange for documentation for some of the workers?
Well, these are all just allegations at this point, but that notion that the company was actually helping provide documents has come up a fair amount in some of the press reports since the raid. But all this is still yet to play out, of course. The government's keeping its cards really close to the vest right now in terms of charging the managers and the owners. What do you make of the 5-month jail sentences that have been given out to the workers who have pled guilty so far? That's a stronger penalty than has become the norm in situations like this.
I think it's absolutely horrible. I think it shows the paucity of humanity that the federal government is showing. These workers did not take jobs away from Americans. Iowans, Minnesotans, Wisconsin people, they don't want to work for $7.25 an hour on a kill floor, you know, wearing waders knee-high in blood.
And we should point out that in the midst of all these allegations and, you know, just about everything we're talking about today is, even though it's been documented to varying degrees by the press and by these affidavits, the company has said not much, right?
The company hasn't said much at all, but that's the MO of this company. It doesn't say anything. I'd be surprised if the company didn't pull out the anti-Semitic card. That's what this company has always done in the past. You're choosing us. You're picking on us because we're Jews.
Now, this is, or has been at least, the world's biggest kosher meat processor. What's the conversation that's happening within the Jewish community, at least in the United States?
There's a sense of embarrassment. I must say, as a Jew myself, as someone who's proudly Jewish, I am embarrassed by what happened. It's really upset many people who are just proud to be Jews that the so-called pious Lubavitchers running this particular plant have broken all sorts of rules, rules from the government, but also rules of how we need to treat our neighbors.
Before I let you go, I want to ask, do you imagine that this situation in Postville, with all of its sordid details, is this going to sort of rip the lid off of the meat processing industry? Or are these sort of egregious details such an outlier that this will be kind of a flash in the pan and business as usual?
Business as usual. I think what the fallout of Postville will be on who does the slaughtering. I don't think the fallout will extend to investigating safety in these slaughterhouses. I don't think the fallout will extend to environmental issues. Those are large, those are endemic issues to slaughtering in America. I think what will happen, though, ultimately, slaughterhouse owners are going to have to raise the minimum wage.
Stephen Bloom, thank you very much for taking some time for In the Loop.
Thanks for asking, Jeff.
Stephen Bloom wrote the book Postville, A Clash of Cultures in Heartland America. He joined us from the University of Iowa. The agriprocessor's plant is up and running again, though at reduced capacity. Following the raids, the company says it's looking for a new CEO to replace the current one, who also happens to be the owner's son. Agriprocessors also says it has signed up for a government electronic verification program to assure it hires only documented workers from now on. You are listening to The Week from In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. We've got a standing call out to listeners to send us their poetic impressions of items in the week's news. Aaron Bells from St. Louis, Missouri, was a news poet even before we came along. And like lots of us this week, he was thinking about natural disasters.
The earthquake that shook Iceland yesterday was smaller than the one that rumbled through central China earlier this May. Less deadly even than the tornadoes that have descended on the Midwest of late, tearing roofs off buildings, sending cars flipping and spinning through the air. We'd like to think our world wants us here, and we have reason to believe it does, but sometimes it reminds us how frail we are, how fragile the things we build are, too. Ask the residents of Hugo, the people of Parkersburg, Iowa. Church, Sunday dinner, then a wall of black sky approaches. Sirens wail, then darkness and panic. The earthquake that shook Iceland yesterday was less devastating, but it leaves us wondering, as a world, what's next? And how can we better enjoy the things we have?
All right, thanks to Aaron Bells in St. Louis. If you've got a short poetic notion from the news, could be serious, funny, or in between, haiku, limerick, you name it, send it to us. We're at minnesotapublicradio.org. Just look for In the Loop. And this is The Week from In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich, trying to grab on to a few of the week's headlines before they slip away from us. Maybe give a little bit of reflection, value added, before we hit the weekend here. Here's something that cropped up on Wednesday. Take it from a former business reporter. Corporations' annual shareholders meetings, usually pretty boring events. But one caught my eye this week, especially as oil prices were going up and then down and then up again. ExxonMobil is the most profitable company in the history of the world. And they faced an uprising by shareholders this week saying essentially Exxon is too heavily invested in oil, of all things. This insurrection was led by members of the Rockefeller family, who owed their family's wealth and their Exxon shares to their oil baron forebear. Now, part of their argument was environmental, but part was economic, a business argument, that oil profits could dry up much faster than Exxon's managers think. They want the company to diversify into other energy sources. In the end, Exxon carried the day, and the CEO proudly proclaimed that for the foreseeable future, oil is where it's at. We asked a couple of guys who actually find and extract oil for a living what they make of this argument that we're about to start running out of oil. John Landreth is a deep water drilling engineer in Houston. He thinks Exxon's got it right. Stick with oil.
Well, I think they're absolutely correct. Oil and gas isn't going away. It's got some problems associated with supply in the coming years, especially if you buy into the peak oil theory. But for the foreseeable future, we're going to be using oil and gas and probably at least 30 years into the future.
Do you like that concept of peak oil as somebody in the industry? Is it useful to you? How do you define it in the first place?
I find the whole notion intriguing. And the idea is that if you follow the production of petroleum from the field level to the county level to the state level, even the country level, it follows a bell curve. And you get to a point where you reach ultimate production, and it really doesn't matter what you do after that point. The field starts to decline. And there's a body of opinion that world oil reserves are getting close to or maybe even at the peak right now. We don't really know. We probably won't know until after the fact.
Now, that doesn't sound so good for a company like Exxon, but you were pretty bullish on their chances going forward.
If we are at peak oil, the implication is not that we're going to run out. It's that it's going to get increasingly expensive and harder to get at what's left. The price is likely to continue to stay high, even if it goes down, which it will. I mean, it always has. It goes up and it goes back down. But when it does go down again, I think the consensus in the industry is that it's not going back to $9. It might go to some value higher, which will be a place where most companies can still be profitable, including Exxon.
All right. John Landreth, deep water drilling engineer down in Houston, Texas. Thanks very much for taking a few minutes for In the Loop.
My pleasure.
Now, we got a little bit different view from Craig Williams. Craig is out in Colorado. He's a reservoir engineer. Basically, he designs oil fields all over the world, Colombia, Alaska, Algeria. Craig thinks we've got very good reason to be worried about the supply of oil, and Exxon should be worried too. To him, the big factor is not how much is left in the ground. It's who controls most of that. Not companies like Exxon, but the nationally owned oil companies in places like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Mexico, and Venezuela.
Their interests are in simply funding their governments. They can do that by investing and producing more oil, or they can simply stand back and see the oil price rise, and they also get additional funding by that means. They're not necessarily have as an objective to make more oil.
What are the implications of that situation for a company like ExxonMobil, who's competing with them but operates a different way?
As their production declines, and they did not produce as much oil in 2007 as they did in 2006, they become more and more buyers of oil to feed their refineries and their marketing system. They don't have access to be able to start new projects.
So Exxon essentially is running out of real estate.
That's right. Access to real estate. The one thing that people miss on peak oil is that it's not dependent on resource, the amount of resource that is supposedly out there.
It's not just geologic factors that will take us to peak oil. It could be political. It could be economic.
Absolutely.
And Craig, oil field engineer, one last question for you.
Sure, yes.
What kind of car do you drive?
A Prius.
It's about as clear a signal as you could give of where you imagine oil supply going.
Yes, certainly.
All right, Craig Williams, thank you very much for talking with us.
All right, certainly. Thank you.
It's kind of amazing how we can dig into our databases and find a couple of oil engineers to help give us a little extra perspective. Something called Public Insight Journalism. And if you want to be a part of it, help us cover the news, you can check it out at minnesotapublicradio.org. Sign up on the In the Loop homepage if you like. Along those lines, a little while ago, we put a call out to our listeners, to our audience, for people who may follow a particular area of the news a little more closely than the rest of us. And we thought maybe we'd see about bringing some of those folks in to give us an update on the week, you know, on their beat. such as it is. And Terry Bly was one person that we heard from, a friend of ours who's been on the show before. Terry, thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So what's the beat that you follow especially closely?
I'm on that bandwagon with the green trend. Anything that has to do with improving the environment and ourselves.
So the week in green, let's call it. And what's the first item that you got for us?
Well, I read this week that Honda just announced that for $600 a month, you can rent their new hydrogen fuel cell car. And I thought, this is great. No emissions. It just emits water vapor.
Does it have a name?
The FCX Clarity.
You can see right through it. Okay, so what, can I get one in Minnesota?
You can only get one in California. There are two cities in California where you can lease this. You also have to be near a fueling station, and there are like three.
Are you thinking fuel cells, though, maybe the future of how we power our cars?
No, unfortunately, and I totally thought it was going to because it seemed like the first clean energy car. But if you dig deeper, you find out that with the technology we have today, it takes about as much carbon-emitting crap to make the hydrogen. So the technology is just not there.
Yeah, baby steps. But one of them this week, in any case. What's the second bit of news that caught your attention this week?
Well, last year, actually, I'd read that the Prius was outselling the Honda Civic Hybrid, not for reasons you might guess, like the way the car runs or the interior, but because people wanted everyone on the street to know they were driving a hybrid. And the Prius looked different. It looked like a hybrid.
Sure does.
Well, I thought that was sort of silly, but as it turns out, Prius and other fuel-efficient cars are sexy.
Scientifically proven now, or
well,
what?
Well, GM released a study this year that found that 8 out of 10 women said that they would find a guy way sexier if he was driving the latest fuel-efficient car than if he was driving the latest sports car.
Okay, so go out and get a visibly fuel-efficient car if you want to hook up. And you've got one more item looking ahead to next week.
Yeah, next week the U.S. Congress is going to debate the cap and trade bill, as it's informally known. They're going to start debating what the United States is going to do in response to the Kyoto Treaty, which we have refused to sign.
We mentioned this to our editor, who very wisely, she said, have her try and describe cap and trade in two sentences.
Okay.
Go.
Cap. 86% of corporations in America will have a cap on how many emissions they can put into the air.
Okay, that's one sentence. Yep.
Trade. The higher polluting companies will get pollution points, basically. If they want to put more energy efficient practices into their company and reduce and not use all their points, they can sell those points to a company that has decided they need more pollution points than they were given, and that company then can buy this more environmentally friendly company's points, hence the trade.
All right. A rather long second sentence, but
we'll
give you a pass.
You said two sentences. Unfortunately, it's probably not going to pass right now, but they're hoping that with a new administration next year, that at least this got the debate going, and then next time they debate it, it'll actually fly.
All right. Terry Bly, thanks for coming in and being our guinea pig for the first try at this sort of the week in X. Glad to have you here.
Well, thank you very much.
If you have an area of the news that you follow particularly keenly and you think you might be interested in coming in to give us a briefing one of these weeks, let us know. MinnesotaPublicRadio.org/InTheLoop. This is The Week from In The Loop, and I am Jeff Horwich. The fun on the political scene this week really belonged to the Republicans for a change. Former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan comes out with a book basically saying all the things you kind of think he might have brought up at the time. And then John McCain has begun vetting vice presidential candidates. Over Memorial Day weekend, he invited a bunch of prospective running mates over to his ranch, mostly governors or former governors. Many of them are very tempting, for different reasons. McCain, you know, he needs to take some time, get to know these guys a little bit. And you have to admit, the whole situation does kind of evoke a certain reality television show. This summer, once again, the search is on. At a secluded, luxurious ranch in Sedona, Arizona, one very eligible man must make a choice.
Well, my friends, you're here because I'm looking for my number two. The V to my P. Just the right person to sit on my ticket. This will not be easy. My friends, there will be tears. But, my friends, I'm confident one of you in this room has what it takes to serve under me.
One man. Six other men. A decision that could shape a nation.
Governor Jindal, I'm glad we finally got some time alone. Do you like the wine?
Oh, it's wonderful, Senator. A deep red, just the way I like it.
Well, my friend, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Let's see. I'm young, energetic. Stomping out corruption gets me very turned on.
Oh, that's good. That's good, my friend. Keep talking.
It's a choice forged over private dinners, intimate horseback rides on the back 40, deep, late-night policy discussions.
Senator, I know we've had our differences in the past, but sitting with you now, here in this hot tub, I just feel so close to you. Governor Romney, I need to ask you to move your foot.
In the end, only one can get the rose that says, "You are my choice." But can six power-hungry men last a week under one roof?
Now, I'm warning you, you'd best stay out of my way, Tim. I can deliver the religious rite.
Oh, yeah, Mike? Well, I hate taxes.
Bring it, beanpole. Hey, what's going on here? Governors, my friends, really, I expected better.
Don't miss the drama, the backroom brawling, the feigned public expressions of disinterest, along with plenty of surprises to keep everyone on their toes.
Hey, boys! Did I hear someone's looking for a vice president?
All right, you go, girl.
But in the end, it comes down to a choice and a rose.
My friends, this has been the most difficult decision of my long, long life.
John, pick me!
Charlie, I'll never forget that night looking up at the stars and flirting with abolishing the IRS.
Senator, I will always love you.
Rob, when we talked about the Bush tax cuts, I felt like we connected on an almost spiritual level.
We were meant to be together.
Mitt, I'm sorry, I just don't like you very much.
Ah, damn it.
Only one person can receive my rose. And my choice, my friends, is...
Don't miss the latest season of ABC's The Candidate, debuting this spring and lasting until it ends.
The Week from In the Loop is produced by Sandon Totten and me, with some help from our friends in public insight journalism. We are edited by Kate Smith. Our theme and most of our jazzy music is by The Smarts. I'm Jeff Horwich, and I know it seems a little bit odd, we've only produced a couple of these, but we're going to take a few weeks off. I'm about to have a baby. Well, my wife is, but I'm involved. After a few weeks of fatherhood, I will return, and The Week from In the Loop will return as well. We'll see you then.